Okay, welcome to the 61st episode of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1, a transitional year resident. I'm ultimately going into radiology. And in today's podcast, we're going to continue cardiopharmacology. In the previous podcast, I believe this is, that was episode 55, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. In episode 55, I sort of laid the groundwork and I talked about the, and that groundwork lecture is probably important. So I'll highly recommend before you start this one, listen to the first episode, because there are a lot of like there's a lot of cardiophysiology and like electronics I discuss that would really help you understand this lecture. So I would highly, highly recommend go back and listen to that one first. Okay. So, we finished the class 1 antiarrhythmics, so we're going to jump to the class 2 antiarrhythmics, right? And the class 2 antiarrhythmics, right, you know that they are the beta blockers, okay? They're the beta blockers. They all end in ola, right? And again, the way these drugs work is they block beta 1 receptors, and by blocking these receptors, right, they basically flatten phase 4 of the pacemaker potential. And think about it, if you flattened phase 4 of the pacemaker potential, right, you know that you're decreasing heart rate. But in addition to doing that, you also, these drugs also decrease contractility, right? So again, please don't forget, right? This is something that you should hopefully know from biochemistry and from cell biology, right? That your beta 1 receptor is GS coupled, right? So ultimately GS, when it's activated, it leads to more calcium in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right? Because you activate adenylate cyclase, you convert ATP to to cyclic AMP, and then that cyclic AMP will activate protein kinase A, and then that protein kinase A can phosphorylate an enzyme known as phospholamban. When phospholamban is phosphorylated, it becomes inactive so that you can actually pump calcium out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum in cardiac myocytes so that you can have a calcium contraction. Although in addition to that, you also have some more stuff with like getting calcium into the cell from extracellular sources in cardiac muscle. I believe I either talked about that in the previous podcast or I'll discuss it at some point in the future. So more calcium aids contractility in cardiac myocytes. That's the big thing you want to take away. And if you activate beta 1 receptors, you get more contractility. But if you block beta 1 receptors with beta blockers, right, you have less contractility. So beta blockers, right, in effect, they are negative inotropes because they decrease cardiac contractility, and they are also negative chronotropes because they decrease the heart rate. So what are some other key things you want to know about the beta blockers, right? So the first thing you want to know is that they prolong the PR interval, right? Because remember, the PR interval on an EKG represents conduction between the atria and the ventricles, right? So that's down the AV node. So if you're a negative chronotrope, right, if you basically slow down phase 4 of the pacemaker potential, which is also the potential that operates in the AV node, right, you prolong the PR interval. Okay, you prolong the PR interval. And then don't forget that your beta blockers, right, like propranolol, for example, is actually used to treat thyroid storm because it inhibits that 5' deiodinase, right, that helps you convert T4 to T3 in the periphery, right? In fact, propranolol is the first drug, very high yield, it's the first drug that you're supposed to give in the setting of thyroid storm. And then remember that you can also give beta blockers to patients with glaucoma. I talked about this in the neuropharmacology podcast, right? Because by blocking beta receptors, you decrease the synthesis of aqueous humor, and that helps you lower intraocular pressures. And then don't forget that you can also use beta blockers for migraine prophylaxis. You don't use them in the acute phase of migraines. That's what triptans are for, okay? But if a patient has, let's say, more than like 8 migraine episodes per month, that sort of qualifies them for taking a chronic migraine prophylaxis. And beta blockers like propranolol are good for those purposes. And then don't forget, in the realm of psychiatry, propranolol can also be used to treat akathisia, okay? So that feeling like those people, like their bodies are like moving, they cannot, they like pace up and down. Patients that are on antipsychotics, you can actually use propranolol for those purposes. And then please do not forget as well, you do not want to give propranolol in the setting of acute CHF exacerbation, right? Because if you decrease the contractile power of the heart in a CHF exacerbation, you can throw those people into like overt cardiogenic shock, and that would obviously not be a good thing, okay? But if a patient has chronic CHF, beta blockers have actually been shown to improve survival. Although it's not all beta blockers, there's three that have been studied and shown to improve survival, and it's actually high yield to know those ones. That's metoprolol, carvedilol, and bisoprolol, okay? So metoprolol, carvedilol, and bisoprolol. Just remember biochemistry, So there's a B, a C, and an M in biochem, and that helps you remember bisoprolol, carvedilol, and metoprolol as the drugs that have been shown to improve survival in heart failure that are beta blockers. There are other drugs there like spironolactone and the works. Okay, ACE inhibitors, you can also throw that into that pile. Okay, so now we've talked about the class 2 antiarrhythmics, let's jump to the class 4. Okay, we'll talk about class 3 in a bit. Your class 4 agents are your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Okay, so this group includes drugs like verapamil and diltiazem. Okay, these non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, they're cardioselective, right? They block L-type, okay, calcium channels. Why do you think I'm going through all the trouble of saying L-type calcium channels? Because it so happens that there are drugs that block T-type calcium channels, right? Use those drugs for the treatment of absence seizures like ethosuximide, okay? So please do not confuse the T-type calcium channels that are blocked by ethosuximide with the L-type calcium channels that are blocked by your non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, okay? Those are your class 4 antiarrhythmics, okay? So these drugs, again, by blocking calcium channels, they decrease heart rate and they decrease contractility. Again, I talked about why that would be the case in episode 55. Now, again, you do not want to give these drugs in the setting of a CHF exacerbation. Okay, and again, since these drugs decrease heart rate, they are negative chronotropes, and since they decrease contractility, they are negative inotropes. Okay, now what can we use these drugs for? We can use them for AFib, okay, because again, by decreasing heart rate, you can use them in a rate control strategy for AFib. And then you can also actually use these drugs in the treatment of variant angina. Previously was known as Prinzmetal's angina, right? So the classic presentation of this is, say for example, you have a smoker, comes in with chest pain, and you say, oh, the chest pain is worse at night, blah, blah, blah. And then you check the troponins and it's elevated. You can even see like ST elevations on an EKG. And then you're like, oh no, let's take this person to the cath lab. They go to the cath lab and you're like, wait, this person's coronary vessels are clear. Okay, think about variant angina. It classically shows up in young people on exams, right? It's a kind of vasospastic disease, right? So basically, if you want to fix this problem, you want to give a drug that causes vasodilation, right? Like a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker like verapamil and diltiazem. And just while we're on this topic, right, you probably want to avoid giving like triptans to these people, right? To patients with a Prinzmetal angina. Because remember that triptans, right, they're serotonin receptor agonists. They cause a vasoconstriction, right? So they are bad for people that have vasospastic disease like Prinzmetal angina. Another unusual step one scenario would be a patient that has a history of crest scleroderma, like a Raynaud's phenomenon, like the R in crest. Again, Raynaud's phenomenon sort of goes along with like vasospasm. So you want to avoid triptans in those people. And then another group of people you want to avoid triptans in will be people that have a that are taking serotonergic medication, right? So like an SSRI or an SNRI or whatever, you can actually trigger serotonin syndrome in those people, right? Because sumatriptan has serotonin receptor agonist activity. And then also people that have Prinzmetal angina or people that have Raynaud's phenomenon, you actually want to avoid, at least avoid a non-selective beta blocker. Because think about it, beta 2 receptors, when you activate them, you cause vasodilation. So if you block those beta 2 receptors, you will get vasoconstriction, right? And that would not be a good thing, right? So non-selective beta blockers are probably not a great idea for patients with Prinzmetal angina or patients with Raynaud's phenomenon. Okay, now while we're on this topic, I just want to go ahead and talk about this drug, ergonovine. Ergonovine is an ergot, it's like an ergot derivative, but think of it basically as a vasoconstrictor, okay? And the thing is, but it's not a great vasoconstrictor, but it does a fair amount of vasoconstriction, right? But why am I harping about ergonovine? Harping about ergonovine because it's actually used as in the provocative test for variant angina, right? So the thing is, for normal people, you give them like a low concentration of ergonovine, they don't get vasospasm from that, right? But if a patient has very sensitive coronary vessels that are prone to vasospasm, aka a patient with variant angina, you give them that low concentration of ergonovine, they can actually get vasoconstriction, and that can help you confirm the diagnosis of variant angina. I mean, obviously, you'd want to do this kind of test in a cath lab, right, in case they get like a true MI from you giving them the ergonovine so that you can intervene pronto, right? So you can actually use ergonovine as a provocative tester for variant angina. Now, Let's jump to the class 3 antiarrhythmics, okay? Class 3 antiarrhythmics. These are the potassium channel blockers, right? So the key drugs here are drugs like amiodarone, dronedarone, sotalol, ibutalide, dofetilide, the all potassium channel blockers, right? So again, please listen to episode 55. Many things I will say here will not make sense without listening to that episode. But basically, these drugs, because they block potassium channels, right, for reasons I described in the previous podcast, they prolong the QT interval, right? So if you prolong the QT interval, right, obviously you can cause a torsade de pointe, which is clearly not a good thing. So let's talk about some of these drugs, right? So the poster child here is amiodarone, right? So amiodarone, yeah, it's a potassium channel blocker. It's a class 3 antiarrhythmic. But the thing is, amiodarone does pretty much every other thing that all the other antiarrhythmics do. It blocks sodium channels. It blocks beta receptors. It also blocks calcium channels as well. So basically, amiodarone is a class 1, 2, 3, and 4 antiarrhythmic, right? So it will prolong the PR interval like your beta blockers do. It would widen the QRS complex like your sodium channel blockers do. It will prolong the QT interval because it's a potassium channel blocker. And it will decrease your heart rate because it has beta blocking activity, right? So basically, if you get a step one question that talks about an antiarrhythmic that just basically screws up the entire EKG, you really want to think about a patient that is on amiodarone. And one high yield thing you want to know about amiodarone is that it contains iodine, right? I mean, if you even look at the name amiodarone, the iodo, there's literally like iodo in its name. So that helps you remember that it contains iodine. And why is that important? The thing is, because it contains iodine, it can play into certain phenomena that I'll probably discuss in a future endocrinology podcast, right? So from endocrine, right, there is something known as the Yod-Basedow phenomenon. The Yod-Basedow phenomenon is basically a phenomenon that describes a patient becoming a hyperthyroid when they get an iodine load, right? So they get iodine, especially in people that have like a history of like iodine deficiency. You give them an iodine load and they can make a ton of thyroid hormone and they can become hyperthyroid. That's actually what's known as the Yod-Basedow phenomenon. Alternatively, there are also certain people that you give an iodine load to and that actually suppresses the synthesis of thyroid hormone. That's something known as the Wolff-Chaikoff phenomenon. And the Wolff-Chaikoff phenomenon or effect, taken together with the Yod-Basedow phenomenon, those things basically describe how amiodarone could potentially cause hyper and hypothyroidism, right? So classically, before a patient is started on amiodarone, you check PFTs, you check LFTs, and you check TFTs. TFT stands for thyroid function test because amiodarone can cause hypo or hyperthyroidism. You check PFTs because amiodarone can cause pulmonary fibrosis, okay? So you obviously want to measure like the FEV1 and stuff like that before you place people on amiodarone. Another thing you also have to check are the LFTs, right? So the thing is, amiodarone is like very lipid soluble, so it can actually collect in the liver, so it's hepatotoxic, okay? So for those reasons, you obtain LFTs, PFTs, and TFTs, okay? And don't forget the other drugs that can cause pulmonary fibrosis, right? So drugs like bleomycin or busulfan or amiodarone or like methotrexate, and also the antibiotic that's used for UTIs, like for cystitis in females, nitrofurantoin, I think it's known as Macrobid, that also does cause a pulmonary fibrosis, although that's pretty rare. Okay, now, other things with amiodarone, right? So I mean, if I don't know how it is with high school in this country, but I did go to high school in Nigeria. And I do remember in high school, we did a certain experiment where we'll take starch and add iodine. If you add iodine to starch, well, voila, the starch turns blue because you have like some kind of like weird reaction going on. So same thing with amiodarone. Amiodarone contains iodine. Well, guess what you find in your skin? Collagen. Collagen is a kind of sugar. So guess what? That collagen in your skin reacts with the iodine in amiodarone and boom, your skin turns blue. So amiodarone can actually cause blue skin, okay? So it can cause like blue skin. You can even have like blue tears on amiodarone, okay? So just sort of keep that at the back of your mind. Contrast this with like methemoglobinemia. I talked about that in the biochem review video where you basically have blue lips. You don't have like generalized blue all over your body. And then the last class 3 drug I'll talk about is sotalol. This occasionally shows up on exams. Sotalol, it blocks beta receptors, right? So it will obviously prolong the PR interval, okay? So now that I'm done with the mainstream antiarrhythmics, let me just say a few words about some other drugs here and there that are sort of like discussed along with antiarrhythmics. The first one I'll discuss is adenosine. So adenosine, the mechanism of action is kind of sketchy, but there's the belief that adenosine activates potassium channels, right? So think about this. Potassium is primarily an intracellular ion, right? Because remember, the sodium potassium ATPase pump takes three sodiums out of the cell and brings two potassiums in. So potassium is primarily an intracellular ion. So if you activate potassium channels, right, potassium will flow down its gradient from inside the cell to outside the cell. And if potassium is leaving the cell, you'll clearly get a membrane hyperpolarization. So if you hyperpolarize the cell, you basically prevent the transmission of action potentials, okay? And you also, again, prevent the firing of cells, right? So what do we use adenosine for? We use it for supraventricular tachycardias. Remember, supraventricular, they are coming from above the ventricles, above the Purkinje system. So would a supraventricular tachycardia be a wide complex or a narrow complex tachyarrhythmia? Well, I hope you're saying narrow complex tachyarrhythmia, okay? If you have an arrhythmia that comes from above the Purkinje system, it's going to be narrow complex, okay? So SVTs are narrow complex tachyarrhythmias. So think about it. If a patient has like an SVT, right, like supraventricular tachycardia, if that SVT is transmitted across the AV node to the ventricles, you can go from ventricles that are beating just fine to VTAC, right? And the thing is, VTAC is not good, right? People actually like die from VTAC, right? So the thing is, if a patient had an SVT, you want to try to block the AV node as quickly and as promptly as possible, right? So the thing is, you can give adenosine to make this happen, right? Because again, by hyperpolarizing the cell, action potentials will stop traveling, okay? You basically shut down the heart for, like, literally adenosine transiently stops the heart, okay? And that helps you break the SVT. Many times it can break the SVT for you. And I mean, usually they give it like in three doses. They give like 6 milligrams. If that doesn't break the SVT, they give like 12 milligrams. If that doesn't work, they give like 12 milligrams to break an SVT. But in addition to being used for SVTs, adenosine also has other uses, especially like its analogs. There are certain adenosine analogs, they all end in like osin, right? So like apadenosine, I think that's spelled as APADENOSON. Okay, so like apadenosine, regadenosine, those are adenosine derivatives, and they are used for cardiac stress tests. In fact, they are used for like pharmacological cardiac stress tests. And the principle they work by is something known as the coronary steel principle. I believe I've discussed that in a previous podcast, but I'm going to describe it again here since I'm talking about cardiology. So I guess I might as well discuss it here, right? So the thing is, because of the mechanism of action of adenosine causing hyperpolarization of cells, it can actually cause a vasodilation, okay? So why is this important? Think about it. If a patient has coronary artery disease, right? They have stenosis of their coronary vessels. The thing is, if you have stenosis of a coronary vessel, the way your body responds is to maximally dilate that vessel, okay? Is to maximally dilate that vessel. So let's assume you then took adenosine or its analogs like apadenosine or regadenosine, right? The other coronary vessels the patient has that are hopefully not stenosed, you dilate those vessels. But the thing is, when you give apadenosine, for example, you dilate the vessels that are not stenosed, but the vessel that is already stenosed, right, the stenosed vessel, is already maximally dilated. So it cannot dilate any further. So because the other surrounding vessels dilate, right, obviously blood flow will increase in these newly dilating vessels. And because blood flow is increasing in these newly dilating vessels, you then have less blood flow through the stenosed coronary vessel that is already maximally dilated. So you're effectively stealing blood from that maximally dilated stenosed coronary vessel. Okay, and if you send less blood through this, again, maximally dilated stenosed coronary vessel, you'll ultimately be in a situation where that part of the heart begins to freak out, right? Because like, oh no, I'm getting less blood, right? So if you have like a positive test, or you see like, if that myocardium is suffering, right, you begin to see like EKG changes, or the patient can begin to say, oh no, my chest hurts. And then you know that's a positive cardiac stress test, okay? That's a test that's based on the coronary steel principle. I mean, alternatively, you could also, for this like vasodilation business, you can give a dipyridamol. Dipyridamol is a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. And if you inhibit phosphodiesterase, that will increase the amount of cyclic AMP in smooth muscle. And actually, increasing cyclic AMP in smooth muscle causes vasodilation. Okay, causes vasodilation. So you can use dipyridamol. It's an antiplatelet drug. You can use it actually to cause the same vasodilatory effect in the coronary steel principle, just as you can use an adenosine analog as well. But don't forget that you can also give like a beta 1 agonist like dobutamine for these pharmacologic stress tests, because by giving beta 1 receptors, you stress out the heart because you're increasing heart rate and contractility. If the patient has a kind of if a patient has a stenosed vessel, right, you may not be able to supply enough blood to meet those increased demands from the beta 1 agonist activity, so you can get a positive stress test with that. Now, one last quick thing with adenosine is that there are certain drugs that actually antagonize the activities of adenosine, right? And those are the methylxanthines, right? So like caffeine, right? Or theophylline that's used to treat a COPD, right? So here's the deal. If a patient is being taken to a pharmacologic stress test that would use adenosine, they should probably lay off the coffee, right? And they should probably also not take the theophylline, right? Because they will not respond to the adenosine analogs that you give in those stress tests, right? So that's kind of like a weird concept that will probably not show up on step one. But if it did, I can almost prognosticate that most people will get it wrong, okay? But please don't get it wrong because you listen to this podcast. Okay, and theophylline is a phosphodiesterase 4 inhibitor. I believe I'll talk about that in a later podcast on pulmonary pharmacology. Okay, now, the next antiarrhythmic-like drug I will discuss is a digoxin, right? So digoxin is it's floridly high yield to know everything about digoxin for your exam. If you don't know about digoxin, you should not be taking step one, okay? That will not be a very good life decision. So, how does digoxin work? Let's say a few things first about how myocardial cells work, right? So myocardial cells, just like pretty much every cell in the body, they have sodium potassium ATPase pumps, right? So that gets three sodiums out of the cell, brings in two potassiums. And then your myocardial cells actually also have something known as a sodium calcium exchanger. Okay, the sodium calcium exchanger. Since sodium, I mean, is primarily extracellular, right? These sodium calcium exchangers, they let sodium come down its gradient into the cell. Okay, and then as that sodium is coming down its gradient into the cell, you use that gradient energy to pump out one calcium, right? So for every three sodiums that comes in, one calcium gets extruded from the myocardial cell. So think about it. If calcium is extruded, you have less calcium available for contractility in the cardiac myocyte. So how does digoxin play into this story? Digoxin plays into this story because it inhibits the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So why will this help? So think about this for a second. If you block the sodium potassium ATPase pump, right, less sodium will be extruded from the myocardial cell. If less sodium is extruded from the cardiac myocyte, your intracellular concentration of sodium will rise. Now think about it. If your intracellular concentration of sodium rises, right, the gradient that the sodium calcium exchanger uses, right, to bring sodium into the cell for you to pump out calcium in secondary active transport goes away, right? Because remember, sodium normally is primarily extracellular, and then it flows down its gradient into the cell for you to pump out one calcium with the sodium calcium exchanger in the process of secondary active transport. So if you block the sodium potassium ATPase pump, you're not sending sodium out of the cell, intracellular concentration of sodium goes up, sodium gradient basically goes away, right? So the sodium calcium exchanger stops working. And if the sodium calcium exchanger stops working, calcium will begin to build up inside the cardiac myocyte. And if calcium is building up, well, guess what? You will have more cardiac contractility. Okay? So the digoxin is actually a positive inotrope. Okay? And the thing is, if a patient has CHF, congestive heart failure, Duloxetine is a great drug, right? Because, I mean, it's increasing your contractility, so it's increasing your stroke volume, right? So it's increasing your cardiac output, right? So increasing this contractility is amazing in the short term. Makes your symptoms of CHF, like, feel a lot better, right? The only thing is the Duloxetine actually does not improve survival. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, there's actually been studies that show an increased risk of death in patients that in some patients that take the Duloxetine for CHF. So the Duloxetine is good for symptoms. It's amazing for symptoms in CHF, but it actually does not improve survival in the setting of CHF. Okay. Because, I mean, this, why might that be the case? I guess I could offer a teleological response, right? So this is just basically, when I say teleological, something that's probably not been proven, but it makes like logical sense if you think through the physiology, right? Think about it. If you're chronically increasing the contractility of the heart, right? You're chronically increasing myocardial oxygen demand, right? So you're stressing out those myocytes above normal, right? So they can get into trouble that way and probably like crap out after some time, right? I mean, think about it. If, for example, someone tells you to like go work out, like lift like 100-pound weights for like 20 hours a day, right? I mean, if you lift weights for like a couple of hours, you probably like your muscles will like give way at some point, and then you'll like I don't know, like collapse and like die or something, right? So think of that happening to your cardiac myocytes. If they keep working hard because they're under the activity of a positive inotrope, they can crap out at some point, and then the cardiac muscle dies. Okay, but just that's my way of understanding why the Duloxetine is potentially not good at improving survival in the setting of chronic CHF. Okay, now another high yield thing about the Duloxetine is that it actually has a muscarinic receptor agonist activity. Okay, so think about it. If the Duloxetine is a muscarinic receptor agonist, that will tell you that it gives a pro-parasympathetic response, right? So it basically causes an increased release of acetylcholine. So it causes a pro-parasympathetic response. So why is that helpful? The thing is, this is helpful because that will clearly, again, listen to episode 55, that will clearly decrease the slope of the phase 4 of the pacemaker potential, okay? So that will actually slow conduction through the AV node. So it so happens that the Duloxetine can actually be used as in a rate control strategy for AFib, because it basically works like a beta blocker almost, right? It slows conduction through the AV node, right? So you could technically also give the Duloxetine for like an SVT again to slow because it slows conduction through the AV node. I mean, obviously in SVTs you can do other things, right? Like you could give adenosine, you can try vagal maneuvers, right? I mean, why do vagal maneuvers work, right? You press on the carotids, the baroreceptors are like, whoa, way too much pressure, right? And when they send those signals to the brainstem, your brain is like, oh no, this person's blood pressure is too high, so let me send a massive parasympathetic discharge, okay? And that could actually slow. By sending the massive parasympathetic discharge, you slow down conduction through the AV node and you can break the SVT. Another thing you can also do is to do like a Valsalva maneuver, right? If you do a Valsalva maneuver, you increase intrathoracic pressures. If you increase intrathoracic pressures, that will also compress on the carotids, on your baroreceptors. And by compressing on those pesky baroreceptors, again, you trick your brain into thinking that you're under like a massive sympathetic response. So your brain says, okay, let me send the parasympathetic discharge, and that can also break the SVT. Another thing you can also do is to dunk the patient's head in cold water. Now that did not come out right. You should gently lower the patient's head into cold water, okay? And that will also basically, again, trick those baroreceptors. You send the massive parasympathetic discharge, and you can quiet down you can break the SVT that way. Okay, so let's summarize a few quick things about Duloxetine, right? So Duloxetine is a negative chronotrope, okay? But it's a positive inotrope because of, right, so it's a muscarinic receptor agonist, so it slows down the heart rate, so it's a negative chronotrope in that respect. But by inhibiting the sodium potassium ATPase pump and raising intracellular calcium, it's a positive inotrope, okay? So the Duloxetine is a negative chronotrope, but it's a positive inotrope. Contrast that with your beta blockers that are negative chronotropes and negative inotropes. They slow down heart rate, but they also slow down contractility. Now, let's see a few more high yield things about digoxin, right? So they actually love to test these things on the USMLEs, like the medicine shelf, on step two, on step three. So let's talk about this real quick. The thing is, I said that digoxin inhibits the sodium potassium ATPase pump. The thing is, it so happens that for digoxin to inhibit the sodium potassium ATPase pump, it actually binds to like the potassium part of the sodium potassium ATPase pump. Okay, so think about it. If a patient is hypokalemic, you're opening up more spots on the sodium potassium ATPase pump for the digoxin to sit on. Okay, so the thing is, the digoxin hypokalemia actually worsens, basically renders you more susceptible to the digoxin toxicity. Okay, so you may say, like, Divine, why is this important? Well, think about it, right? Who takes the digoxin for the most part? Patients with CHF, right? Well, it so happens that patients with CHF may also be taking water pills, aka diuretics, right? And diuretics, one of their classic side effects, because they make your volume down, is hypokalemia, right? Because if your volume down, you'll rev up the activity of your renin angiotensin and aldosterone system, right? So diuretics cause hypokalemia. Well, if you're taking a digoxin and taking a diuretic, the hypokalemia that you get from the diuretic can predispose you to getting digoxin toxicity, okay? But another weird thing, and I guess let me say some more things here before I talk about the other weird thing, right? So what are the signs of digoxin toxicity, right? So digoxin can cause yellow vision, right? So basically, they describe a patient that has heart failure and they're taking some meds for heart failure and they have like vision problems, like yellow vision. Basically, you want to think about digoxin toxicity, okay? Digoxin can also cause like abdominal pain, right? So it can cause like some GI symptoms. Digoxin actually increases the risk of arrhythmia, right? So it can cause early after depolarizations, as I described in episode 55, right? And that can prolong the QT interval. You can go into torsade at the point and die, right? So again, that's clearly not a good thing. Now, how do you treat digoxin toxicity? You can treat digoxin toxicity with anti-DIG Fab fragments. I believe in the hospital, these things are known as a DigiBind, okay? They are monoclonal antibodies against digoxin, okay? The anti-DIG Fab fragments. Now, what is the other weird thing I said I will discuss about digoxin? The other weird thing is, again, it all goes back to the mechanism of action. Digoxin blocks the sodium potassium ATPase pump. And I said that the sodium potassium ATPase pump takes three sodiums out of the cell and brings two potassiums in. So if you block that pump, guess what? You will no longer be bringing potassium into the cell, right? If you're no longer bringing potassium into the cell, right, you can imagine that your extracellular concentration of potassium will go up. So digoxin can actually cause hyperkalemia. So why did I say this is a weird point? I mean, it's an obvious point. It makes perfect sense, but here's where you do not want to mix things up on your test. Digoxin, by virtue of its mechanism of action, causes hyperkalemia. But if you are hypokalemic, you are more susceptible to digoxin toxicity, as I described earlier. Do not mix those two points up. The NBME counts on you to mix those points up. Do not be one of those people. I'll repeat it again. Digoxin, by blocking the sodium potassium ATPase pump, causes hyperkalemia. But for digoxin to do its job, it binds to the potassium spot on the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So, if you're hypokalemic, there are more open spots for digoxin to bind on the sodium potassium ATPase pump. So that renders you more susceptible to digoxin toxicity. Okay. Now, last drug I'll discuss today is ranolazine. Okay, ranolazine is just one of these drugs that probably showed up in the last one or two iterations of first aid for step one, right? So it's a new drug, so it's probably high yield to know about, okay? So how does ranolazine work? Ranolazine works by inhibiting something known as a late sodium channel, okay? The late sodium channel, it's a channel, right? So because it's a channel, it basically lets things flow down their concentration gradient. Right, so it's governed primarily by a concentration gradient, and we know that sodium is primarily an extracellular ion. So a late sodium channel will let sodium flow into the cell. Okay, so think about it. If you block these late sodium channels, less sodium is flowing into the cell. If less sodium is flowing into the cell, your intracellular concentration of sodium will decrease. If your intracellular concentration of sodium decreases, right, you're basically creating a stronger gradient for the sodium-calcium exchanger that you find on the surface of cardiac myocytes. If you increase that gradient, right, you will actually pump more calcium out of the cardiac myocyte. And think about it. If you're pumping more calcium out of the cardiac myocyte, that cardiac myocyte is not contracting. In fact, if it's not contracting, it's doing the opposite of contracting. It's relaxing. And if it's relaxing, that means you're basically putting that cardiac myocyte into diastole. In fact, you're promoting something known as diastolic relaxation. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I believe these are known as this phenomenon is known as lusitropy, right? Lusitropy is basically diastolic relaxation of a cardiac myocyte, okay? So ranolazine improves the lusitropic properties of cardiac myocytes. Because again, when cardiac myocytes are in a contractile state, right, they're in systole. But if they're in a relaxed state, they're in diastole, right? And you may say like, Divine, why would ranolazine help if it's promoting diastolic relaxation? Well, think about it. If you're promoting diastolic relaxation, right, you'll get more preload. If you get more preload, according to the Frank Starling principle, you get more cardiac output, right? Alternatively, think about this concept as well. If when coronary vessels perfused, is it in systole or in diastole? Well, hopefully you know that your coronary vessels are perfused in diastole. So if you're promoting more diastolic relaxation, right, you're promoting more perfusion of your coronary vessels because coronary vessels perfuse in diastole, right? And that can actually help relieve the symptoms of angina, okay? So this is why ranolazine is a great drug for the treatment of angina, okay? Although classically for angina, you use nitroglycerin, okay? And why am I harping on ranolazine? I'm harping on ranolazine because there are many wonderful things they can test about this. One, they can test about how it promotes diastolic relaxation. Another thing is they can test it in the context of digoxin, right? Like a compare and contrast kind of question. Because remember, digoxin, I said that digoxin, if you sort of skip back a few minutes, it raises your intracellular sodium. So that decreases the extrusion of calcium from a cardiac myocyte. Versus ranolazine that causes less sodium to go into the cardiac myocyte. So it decreases intracellular sodium. So that increases the gradient for the sodium-calcium exchanger. So it decreases intracellular calcium and basically promotes diastolic relaxation, right? So it's kind of like the opposite of the way digoxin works, although they target many different things, okay? And another reason why ranolazine may be good for angina, right, is because by promoting diastolic relaxation, right, it's decreasing myocardial oxygen demand, right? So if your heart does not have to work as hard, right, then you would not need as much blood supply to meet the demands of the heart, right? So you probably will stop having anginal symptoms with that. Okay. Although I guess one weird thing, this is super low yield. You probably never see this on a test, but ranolazine also actually blocks potassium channels. Okay. So it can cause QT prolongation, right? So it has some class 3 antiarrhythmic effects. So I think this has gone on for long enough. So I'm going to stop here. I am unfortunately not yet done with cardiac pharmacology. So we'll have another podcast, but I think with the other podcast, we'll probably be able to finish cardiac pharm or maybe like in 2 podcasts. Because I'll also have to talk about like the anti-lipid medications and all that stuff. And before I sign off, I just want to mention that I offer tutoring, private tutoring for the USMLE step 1, 2, and 3 exams. Okay. I offer for like step 2 CK and step 2 CS. And I also do like application advising, right? So if you're applying to med school or you're applying to residency, I do application advising, and I can help you put together a very solid application for med school and for residency. So if you know anyone that needs any of those services, feel free to reach out, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com, or you can use the contact whatever thingy at the top of my website. So I wish you all the best. I hope you enjoy this podcast. I will try as much as possible to keep making more. If you notice, I haven't done any one since October 29th. I've been on a medicine rotation in residency, and you know how medicine rotations go. So, but I'll try to make some more in the next few days, and I wish you all the best. Hopefully the Lakers win tonight. So have a wonderful rest of the day. God bless. I'll see you next time.